mission. We want the crowd loud. Fist pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today we spend the hour talking about whistleblowers and the importance of whistleblowing. We'll talk with Robert McLean about his recent victory at the Supreme Court, which was a big one for whistleblowers and the Whistleblower Protection Act. We speak with attorney Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project about the case and what this means in the bigger picture. Please stay with us.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive force of slavery for almighty.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program is dedicated to whistleblowers and whistleblowing and the importance of that in our purported democratic republic. We're going to be speaking with whistleblower Robert McLean about his recent victory at the Supreme Court. We'll also speak with attorney Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project about that case and what this means for the bigger picture. Here is my co-host Peter Phillips to introduce both guests today.
Robert McLean was a federal marshal, air marshal, who spoke up about the consequences of dangerous government decision to remove air marshals from long-distance flights during what was then termed a serious terrorist alert. This was after 9/11. Because he blew the whistle, the government changed policy and potential tragedy was averted. But Mr. McLean paid a hefty price. 3 years later, he was fired for disclosing what was retroactively called a sensitive security information, even though it was released by his employers as a public document, literally. They sent it out in an open email. He appealed the termination in January of 2015. The Supreme Court ruled in McLean's favor in a 7-2 decision after an 8.5-year battle. Robert lives in Southern California with his wife and three children. Robert, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
Also with us is Tom Devine. He's the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, where he worked since January of 1979. Since that time, Tom has assisted over 6,000 whistleblowers in defending themselves against retaliation and making real differences on behalf of the public. Tom has been a leader in the campaigns to pass and defend nearly 30 major national and international whistleblowers.
Tom Devine is going to be joining us a little bit later in the program, and we're going to begin with Robert McLean right now. So, Robert, since we have you on the line, would you please tell our listeners what exactly was your case about, and why do you find it important for the protection of whistleblowers?
I was in the first class of air marshals to graduate right after the 9/11 attacks. So I joined up pretty quick, and things were going really well until a new management took over, which primarily existed of retired Secret Service senior executives. And that's when things started getting really dangerous and nonsensical. First started in the summer of 2002 was a very hardcore, extreme business dress code that we had to adhere to, and we were forced to board in front of the general public. So pretty much anybody who was looking for us knew exactly who we were and where we were placed. So after a year of these policies and several air marshals that I knew tried to change these policies through proper channels and through members of Congress and the committees, And on July 26th of 2003, we were all called in to undergo emergency training. And this was not a briefing that we could get via the phone, via email. We had to come into the field office, go into a secure area, and get a briefing. And the briefing was there was an Al-Qaeda plan to smuggle weapons onto aircraft from countries outside of the United States and into airports that had central security screening hubs. The best example is Dulles or Denver Airport. There's only one central screening area, and once you're past that, you're free to roam the airport, whereas some airports have multiple screening areas throughout the airport. Therefore, you could possibly have to go through screening one more time if you had to connect flights. And what the terrorists were going to do was to take advantage of a screening loophole in which the State Department didn't have to do a background check on you, regardless if you came from a terrorist list country. Because you were just transiting the United States, you didn't have to go through the same background requirements. So they were going to exploit that, smuggle weapons onto aircraft using camera equipment and children's toys, and attack the crew, take over the aircraft, and fly them into European and U.S. West Coast targets.
Robert McLean, how much evidence then was there in your estimation of the of these types of possibilities?
The way they briefed us, they said this was imminent. We never had such a training before, and the policy was pretty common knowledge that the State Department waived these background checks if you're transiting the United States. Also, before my disclosures, even if you flew in from a foreign screening area into a U.S. airport, you did not have to undergo screening measures, and that changed also. Anytime you come in from a foreign airport into the U.S. and go on to another flight, you have to go back through screening again.
So, Robert, you were on flights, you were watching for people that might fit this description, and these sometimes were flights to and from Europe or other countries, is that correct?
When we were given the briefing, pretty much any flight that we were going to be on that required a hotel room pretty much covered any flight that was 3 hours or longer. So that could have been simply a flight from Los Angeles to Chicago.
Oh, I see. Okay, so these flights that required a hotel room, and Homeland Security decided they were spending too much money and canceled any flights that were like that so they could save money on hotel bills at the same time that they were saying there was this general alert and a necessity to really be watching for terrorist attacks. And you blew the whistle on that. So what did you do?
Like I've said before, I've told a lot of how I testified. We thought it was a mistake. I confirmed it with other air marshals in field offices across the country. It made no mistake because we just had this briefing that we're going to be under attack immediately. And this unsecured text message blasted out to our low-budget cell phones to cancel hotel rooms. And at the same time, we had a $22 million encrypted smartphone system to receive sensitive or classified information. The agency chose to send that information to our unsecured phones to tell us to cancel all our hotel reservations in order to avoid late cancellation fees.
You let officials know this outside of Homeland Security, and it became a big scandal, and they were embarrassed and reversed the decision, thanks to you, and that was great. And then 3 years later, they decide that the information you released was sensitive, sort of retroactively, and they fired you. You appealed, and there was this long court thing that finally ended up at the Supreme Court that you won. Congratulations. That's really an important thing. How do you feel about the Supreme Court decision?
It's an honor to have nine such distinguished people rule on your case. They felt it was a very important issue. And either way it went, I've always felt vindicated, and I always knew that at the time, that the information that I had and my actions that I did were not illegal, and I believed what I was doing was protecting the public. So even if they would have ruled against us I would have been happy with the decision, because then it would have forced Congress or the president to take their own action. But as the Supreme Court ruled, they said this was not something that they get involved in. Only Congress or the president, through an executive order, can say that a violation of these regulations holds the same weight as a violation of law.
And Tom Devine, you're the director of the Government Accountability Project, and you had involvement in this case. You're now with us on the phone.
Howdy.
You've been listening in to Robert for the last several minutes?
For sure.
Let's bring you into the conversation here with Robert. What was your role in the case? Tell our listeners. But what's your perspective on that?
We had been just kind of supportive, good offices in the case. But a week before Robert's hearing on defending against the charges, his attorneys withdrew from the case, so we agreed to sub for them and recruited the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association to team up with us.
Why did they withdraw? Do you know? Can you say?
It was a financial dispute, and that just wasn't relevant to us at the Government Accountability Project. Robert's rights have been violated. He deserved help, and it was on issues that were fundamental to the survival of the Whistleblower Protection Act, so we weren't going to worry about getting a budget before we did any further work to help him. And since then, we did the hearing, and we've done all the appeals, and I gratefully accepted the offer by Neil Katyal, the former acting solicitor, to join the team for the Supreme Court argument, and agreed for him to give the oral argument. Somebody who's 121 straight cases at the Supreme Court can't do much better than that.
Sounds like definitely a good thing that the Government Accountability Project jumped in, really looking at the principles behind Robert McLean's case, or else perhaps it would have just died there?
I'm sure that Robert wouldn't have been passive under any circumstances, but I think that it made a difference that we got into the case. But we got into the case because he had made a difference. I've been representing whistleblowers since 1979. I've worked with about 6,000 whistleblowers during that time frame. And Robert's impact in preventing a disaster is unsurpassed among any of the thousands of whistleblowers that I've worked with. And the idea of somebody like this not having free speech rights, it was just inconceivable to me in principle. And also the case involved the survival of the Whistleblower Protection Act, totally outside of the impact on the country and the concept of justice for doing the right thing. The Whistleblower Protection Act was at stake here. The legal theory that had been accepted by President Bush's Merit Systems Protection Board, and to a watered-down degree even by President Obama's board, was that an agency secrecy regulation could cancel out the free speech rights that Congress had unanimously passed in the Whistleblower Protection Act. And if that's the case, then the Whistleblower Protection Act is just an honor system that agencies can cancel it at will if they think that it's going to make them look bad. They just issue a gag rule within their own organization. And the Supreme Court just decisively rejected that theory. They said that only Congress can weaken the free speech rights that they created in this law. Agencies can't do it. Congress can't even pass the buck, as they tried to do in this case, that DHS should issue secrecy regulations when they think that whistleblowing is dangerous. No, Congress has to do it themselves. And that's the highest ground for us, because Congress has enacted these rights unanimously 4 times. And now the Supreme Court has teamed up with Congress to defend this law. We're feeling pretty good about the outcome.
I'm looking at a picture of you walking out of the Supreme Court, and certainly Robert's got a really big smile on his face, and you look pretty happy as well. That's an amazing victory, and we certainly applaud that work, and we think it's really important that whistleblowers have that kind of protection. But, Robert, can you tell us the impact it had on you? 8.5 years, you were fired from your job. Where do you stand now?
First of all, I got to say, Tom is being extremely humble about his role in my case. Tom has been, pretty much from the beginning, the lead attorney, almost working by himself for a good part of the last 8 to 9 years. Even when I had the original attorneys working on the case, Tom was slaving away on assisting them with the motions and being involved. So I couldn't have done this without Tom whatsoever. He's been the lead, and thank goodness for him and the Government Accountability Project and practically their entire staff. But as far as me, I obviously it's very difficult to get another job if you're busy litigating against such a huge and important federal agency. I applied with almost every police department in Southern California, and every single one said thank you, but no thank you. Some even went as far as saying that they had to disqualify me due to integrity.
That's an ironic statement, Robert McLean.
They actually put it in writing, too. So it's
that's amazing.
You know what? Being in law enforcement, these things, they don't surprise you. They really don't want anyone who can possibly question problems with authority.
Chains of command and that sort of thing. Right, exactly. Well,
to tell you the truth, I don't feel it's hard for me to say how much this has been hard on me, because to me, this is what I do. This is what I've been pre-programmed to battle until there's nothing left to battle. But the toll it's taken on my wife has been the biggest issue.
Robert McLean, what's next for you since this momentous victory, 7-2 at the Supreme Court? What's next on your docket? Are you working on a book or writing or anything like that?
There is a potential investigative journalist who has been involved in my case. He used to be a reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, has expressed, and I'm very happy to bring him on, putting together a story about not just my case, but a lot of what's happened post 9/11. And also, I'm hoping that the government will finally put this thing to rest and give the taxpayers some rest, and federal employees don't have to second guess what they can or can't do anymore. So hopefully we can settle this out. But if the government wants to keep brawling with me, I've got another 10 years left to do it.
Well, Robert McLean, we thank you for your courage and standing up and actually showing what we would define as integrity. And, you know, I had the pleasure of very briefly meeting you in Washington, D.C. at the Whistleblower Summit this past July, I believe. And, again, it was a pleasure to do that. I'm very grateful that the case was decided in your favor and certainly in favor of whistleblower protection. Robert McLean, we'll hopefully check in with you sometime here in the near future to find out how that investigative report might be coming.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on.
You're very welcome, and thank you. Tom Devine, you're going to stay on with us for the hour. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We are spending the hour talking about whistleblowers. We just talked to Robert McLean. His Supreme Court case decided in his favor 7-2. His attorney, Tom Devine, the Government Accountability Project. Tom Devine is on the line with us for the rest of the program to talk about whistleblowers and the Government Accountability Project in general. Robert McLean's case, which is very important, I think maybe was lesser known to some in the public than, say, Thomas Drake, certainly Chelsea Manning. We're going to talk in general about the importance and significance of whistleblowing, and we'd like to have Tom Devine share some of his insights and maybe some of his highlights of his career and how he has seen whistleblowing and the trajectory go in the United States, certainly in through the Obama years. So, Tom Devine, thank you again for taking time out to be on the Project Censored Show today. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your experience over the years? Granted, this is a major Supreme Court victory. We were just talking with Robert McLean, but where do you see the trajectory going? Things during the Obama years haven't been going so well, but given your expertise, maybe you can wrap some of this up for our listeners.
I think the most significant thing is that whistleblowers have won not just a legal revolution since I came in 1979, but a cultural revolution. When I came to GAP, whistleblowers were generally, as a rule, they were considered people who were kind of nutty or maybe disloyal, traitors. Some whistleblowers were viewed as courageous heroes, profiles in courage, but that was the exception, not the rule. And I started to realize that things were changing in 2002 when I saw the cover of Time magazine, and there was three women whistleblowers on the cover. And when I came to GAP, women didn't usually have good enough jobs to be significant whistleblowers. There was so much discrimination. And I realized we're coming a long way, baby. Women now are in positions of authority where they can bear witness witness to significant abuses of power. And time picks those people because they're the folks who are changing the course of history. And that's been the role of whistleblowers throughout history. They're the pioneers of change. They keep our society from being stagnant. They ask the questions that are uncomfortable. Sometimes they're right. Sometimes they're wrong. But we need them so much because stagnation is like the death of a society. And then I realized it was getting better after the 2006 elections when Congress changed hands to a Democratic House and Senate. And the Democracy Corps did a survey. It was a survey to the swing voters, the people whose votes, who had switched parties and whose votes were responsible for switching political control of Congress. And the questions were, what's your top priority for the new Congress? And the first priority was to eliminate illegal government spending. That was picked by 83% of people. The second priority was stronger rights for whistleblowers, picked by 79% of the people. This is ahead of ending the Iraq War, national health insurance, taxes. It was stronger rights for whistleblowers. And we have the public on our side now. And with that kind of solidarity, whistleblowers are going to have more and more of an impact. As far as the kind of the trends for legal rights, there's been a legal revolution. I've been involved with getting 32 whistleblower laws passed at GAP from the municipal level to the United Nations. It's the most dynamic area of law globally. It's a phenomenon. The dark side of that, though, is as the rights have gotten stronger, it's kind of made, and as whistleblowers are making more of a difference, it's made them more threatening. And what I've learned at GAP is that the intensity and likelihood of retaliation, the ugliness of retaliation, is in direct relationship to the severity of the threat posed by a whistleblower, the threat to an abuse of power. The more significant the whistleblower's disclosure, the more knowledge that person have, the uglier it's going to be. And it's ironic, but the rates of retaliation have increased sharp since the legal rights have gotten stronger for whistleblowers. So in many ways, it's the best of times and the worst of times for the folks that I serve. And you see that same sort of schizophrenia within the Obama administration. The Obama administration has appointed the strongest, most committed champions of free speech to the boards that enforce these employment laws in history. There's never been such dedicated people to freedom of speech running the boards that implement whistleblower rights. And President Obama's law school roommate, the White House Council for Ethics, Frontline's partner with us getting the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act passed, which created the strongest free speech rights in history for government workers. But at the same time, they've prosecuted more people for blowing the whistle under the Espionage Act than all other presidents in history. The Obama administration's right now trying to cancel normal due process rights for government workers under an all-encompassing national security loophole that they've created called non-critical sensitive jobs, which would mean you don't have the right to defend yourself. The rule of law doesn't exist for you anymore because you're a sensitive worker, and they've written up rules that'll make the whole federal labor force sensitive workers. These are timeless struggles, and although we've had more victories than I ever fantasized, I wouldn't say that we're closer to it being safe to commit the truth than it ever was before. That's what we call whistleblowing at GAP, committing the truth, because you're treated like you committed a crime.
Tom Devine, Legal Director of Government Accountability Project, you're joining us for the hour today. Tom Devine, could you please give our listening audience the website?
The website's easy to remember. It's www.whistleblower.org. And there's a legislative page there that's got our campaign to close the loophole in rights for intelligence community contractors. There's another campaign very relevant to what happened to Thomas Drake. It's to decriminalize whistleblowing. The way the law is set up, it's ironic. It's illegal to fire people for the same whistleblowing disclosures that the government prosecutes them for. And that's another inexcusable loophole in the free speech rights that we're fighting to close. And we'd love support from your listeners.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we're focusing on whistleblowers and whistleblower protection. We are joined by Tom Devine. legal director of the Government Accountability Project. Tom Devine has been involved with so many whistleblower cases, 6,000 over the last several decades. He has also a book. It is the Corporate Whistleblower's Survival Guide. And this is, again, very important work, several hundred pages here, sort of a how-to. Tom Devine, there is something in the book that Peter Phillips and I were particularly interested in you talking about. And whether or not you go through each one of these things, I suppose, is up to you. But you have part of the book that talks about, well, what goes into whistleblowing? What can people really anticipate if they find themselves in a situation where they are witnessing some wrongdoing and they want to blow the whistle on it? This book basically says, hang on, here's some things that might happen. And you have 13 what you call survival guide tips for people that might engage in the whistleblowing process. Can you talk about some of those for the listeners?
Oh, sure. I think you can group a couple of them. One is to pursue solidarity. The magic word for whistleblowers to make a difference and commit the truth and get away with it is not legal rights. It's solidarity. When they have solidarity, they generally turn information into power, and they have a lot of impact, and it becomes very dangerous to attack them. If they're isolated, it's dangerous to know too much, and the power of the evidence will never become reality. So the solidarity starts with your family, with your loved ones, to make sure that it's a decision by all the people who are affected. This is a life's crossroad choice. Your life will never be the same, and you may go to hell and back and then find yourself up in heaven in terms of all your expectations and things, but you will go to hell. And whether or not you make it back or not is another matter. But all the people affected by that decision need to buy into it. Or the whistleblower who's just kind of, you know, courageously and boldly put his or her family functioning at risk, subjected the kids to ridicule at school, the wife to isolation in the community, that whistleblower is liable to find him or herself alone. It starts there. Then you want to have solidarity with your peers at the workforce. That means doing your homework. You may well be mistaken. And even if you're not mistaken due to an error or just not having the big picture, it's very lonely to be right if nobody's joining you in your dissent. And it's very easy to trash and discredit one whistleblower. It becomes impossible to trash and discredit 50 whistleblowers. Say they're all nuts or they're all trying to cover up their own misconduct. Everybody's lying except the people benefiting from the abuse of power. You're going to need them to make an informed decision whether or not you can make a difference. So a whistleblower starts to dissent against abuse of power and either quits in the middle or just gets smashed. It would have been better if they'd remained a silent observer. The abuse of power would be stronger for having weathered their challenge. So you want to line up not just your evidence to solidarity with the facts, but line up other witnesses. Make sure there's going to be people backing you in the investigations after you stick your neck out. And then there's solidarity with the public. Our strategy at GAP is very simple. We call them legal campaigns, not legal cases. And our belief is, I warn whistleblowers, if the only thing you've got going for you is your legal rights, then you're in big trouble. You need solidarity with the public. So what we do is play information matchmaker between the isolated whistleblower who's at the hub of intense pressure to keep the truth about an abuse of power within the organizational circle, within that small circle, not to get outside of organizational walls. And we break through those walls with our matchmaking and get the information to everybody who should be benefiting from the isolated whistleblower's knowledge. It may be rival corporations or other government bureaus who are competing with the one that's covering something up. They end up blowing the whistle more righteously than the whistleblower. They think they can help them in the process. It's all the government agencies who have any law enforcement responsibilities or regulatory. And we go to all of them so that they end up having to compete against each other. They don't have the option to cover up if it's just like at one agency. We'll go to the Congress with it, the oversight committees, the local community governments, the media, at every level of the media that's possible. They're the lifeblood for the public to be informed and aware. And then we go to the public through the lifers, you know, here in Washington, D.C., the public interest groups, Consumer Federation of America, or Center for Science in the Public Interest, or Union of Concerned Scientists, the people who've devoted their careers and accumulated expertise to get solidarity with the whistleblower. And then the people who are affected by it, the communities whose families may be threatened by that abuse of power. And we go for solidarity with the experts, too, like one of our clients, Aldrich Saucier. He was the Army's chief scientist, and he blew the whistle on the next generation of Star Wars. The Army fired him for being incompetent by challenging the value of Star Wars and spending $1 trillion for the son of Star Wars that they had planned. Well, we went out and got solidarity from the independent experts, from Nobel Prize winners, from chairs of Ivy League departments. They all said that the attacks on Mr. Saucier were incompetent, that he was following sound principles of physics. Solidarity makes the difference there, and that's a common theme in those 13 tactics. The second theme is do your homework. This is going to be the most high-stakes, significant challenge of your life. The other side, they'll try to smother your charges, whether it's with lies or with the truth. And they've got unlimited resources to rebut. And you better have all your documents out before you expose yourself as a threat. And you better have plenty of evidence so that you can catch them. And then use it strategically, like Mr. Snowden did. Don't release it all at once. Let the institution that's abusing its power lie and use the evidence to catch them in their own lies. And then their credibility will start to go into a free fall. The third basic theme is give the organization a chance without exposing yourself as a threat. Once you expose yourself as a threat, the flow of information dries up, you start becoming a target. But there's ways to give the organization a chance without saying, you know, I think you guys are crooks, and what do you have to say about it? It's to thoughtfully raise in meetings, are we risking liability here? You know, how could this backfire against the shareholders? Or are we going to be hauled down to Congress, our agency, if we try to do this? I've seen that they've been pretty hostile towards these types of moves in the past. We really want to risk having our boss raked over the coals here. You give them a chance to tell their side of the story. It's only fair. It's necessary for quality control. And it cuts them off at the pass for the excuse of plausible deniability. Otherwise, the employer will say, whether it's a government agency or a company, well, of course he would have done the right thing. If only I'd known about it, but he went behind my back, or she went behind my back, and you don't want to give them that opportunity.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. After this musical break, we'll be joined again by Tom Devine.
I'm sick and tired of hearing I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of tricky dicky's gonna mother her, but stop, so me, but just a pocket full of hope. Money for dough. Money for
to
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Speaking with Tom Devine, he's the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, and he is giving us really a primer on what to consider if you find yourself in a position where you might be considering being whistleblower, some things you might want to think about. This is all part of his book on the Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide. Tom Devine, I know you can continue down that trajectory, but I wanted to at least briefly shift a little the direction here to find this out, given that you have had such extensive background working with so many whistleblowers, including Robert McLean and so many others. How is it that you decide, or that the Government Accountability Project decides, which cases to really pick up? Which stories do you end up taking on? And because I know that there are likely so many people that contact the Government Accountability Project, and maybe you in particular, that have a story to tell. And what is it that helps you decide which ones are the ones where you'll devote your limited resources?
Well, the first thing we do is decide if we believe in the whistleblower. They don't have to be right, but the idea is that this is information that should be out in the open, on the record, to make informed, responsible choices when there's an impact on the public. The second thing that we do is check if GAP can make a unique contribution. We're a small organization. There's only 20 of us on salary. You know, if there's other organizations that are throwing themselves into it, we don't just pile on. We want to do something where we can have a unique impact. And then we make sure that it's realistic in terms of resources and that sort of thing. And that's also the fourth factor, then, is the significance to the public. And in terms of significance, we have a couple of sub-criteria. One is we're much more likely to take a case if it's supporting witnesses who are backing the pioneer whistleblower. Solidarity is the magic word, and if we want the person who stuck his or her neck out first to survive, we've got to be there for all the people who are willing to demonstrate solidarity with them. Another criteria is, will this have a significant impact on expanding free speech rights? Could this be a significant precedent? Robert McLean's case was that way because it was going to be the precedent to determine whether agencies could cancel out the congressional free speech rights based on their internal secrecy rules. And then the third is, we're just always much more interesting cases that will have a real significant impact on public health and safety, as opposed to fraud cases that could get a lot of money back into the Treasury under the False Claims Act or things. There's oodles of lawyers working on those cases, bounty cases at the SEC, and they're more commercial. If we can actually have an impact on people's lives and prevent tragedies, that always strikes the loudest chord with us.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're talking to Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project. Peter?
Tom, you know, I'm looking through this book, and it's quite an amazing thing. It reminds me, Project Censored, we get calls all the time from people who have tried to blow the whistle on something, and they're kind of at that isolation stage, and they say, I'm being censored. Well, in many cases, there really isn't much we can do at that point. They've already put it up on a website or something like that. But I certainly was paying attention to your chapter two, which is the tactics of retaliation. So these are people who were employed inside of organizations, and not only in the case of Robert McLean where he was fired, but other things happen. And invariably, even if the facts are right, the individual is personally attacked. They're in some way denigrated and or diminished. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience with retaliation tactics?
Well, the tactics of retaliation are limited only by the imagination. So I'm constantly impressed by the creativity of people who want to suppress the truth. They're very good at it. The first principle, though, is what I call the smokescreen syndrome. It's to distract from the whistleblower's charges, and that usually means shifting the spotlight from the dissent, the whistleblower's evidence about abuses of power, to the dissenter. Like what happened with Jeffrey Wigand, the tobacco insider whistleblower, was a great example of that. The company hired an investigative firm to go out and find everything that could possibly be twisted into dirt. Dr. Wigand, and within 6 weeks, published a biography of him that was all trash talk. the government invariably, their first step will be to open up, when one of their own blows the whistle, to begin a witch hunt, to open up a retaliatory investigation, find any dirt they can that'll justify going after the whistleblower and trashing them and punishing them in the same time. Like one gentleman who blew the whistle on just horrible corruption at the Department of Labor, Office of Inspector General, covering up sexual harassment by Miriam Berry a year, decade before he was finally caught engaging in that, and all sorts of corruption, collusion with organized crime figures and connection with union investigations. And the Labor IG went back 30 years, interviewed 300 people before they finally found some dirt to prosecute him on, that he hadn't disclosed some defaulted loans on his credit union application. They prosecuted him for every one of those loans, for six felonies. And that leads into a second one of the major tactics. It's terrorized the whistleblowers. The current tactic, since the employment rights have gotten stronger, is to prosecute them. And most of them don't end up in Espionage Act cases. The routine of this is a criminal investigation where the person just has this hanging over their head for maybe years, or in one case, 30 years. They were serial criminal investigations. So as soon as one would get closed within a month, they would open up a new one. The person was constantly under criminal investigation. He was blowing the whistle on bribery in the Chicago meat yard, bribery to the USDA graders. And these criminal retaliations are really scary. They're worse than employment retaliations. For one thing, they're so much easier. You know, you want to fire somebody, you got to get the lawyers involved, and there'll be depositions and hearings and legal briefs and all sorts of work involved. With criminal harassment, all you need is one bully. One investigator who enjoys being a bully and to threaten and harass the whistleblower. Then the second thing is you can't lose. They don't risk anything. You try to fire somebody, they might win their lawsuit. You do a witch hunt on somebody, the worst that will happen will be you close the case. And then, like I said, you can reopen a new one in a few weeks or months. And then it's so much more effective. Mm-hmm. It's the chilling effect, the freezing effect, terrorizing whistleblowers into silence. If it's going to cause horrible stress to lose your job, that's nothing compared to the fear of going to jail.
Sounds like you've had a lot of experience over the years dealing with all of these manifestations of these types of retaliation. I just wanted to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're talking to Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project. Again, Tom Devine, to say he is expert in all matters whistleblower is an understatement.
Certainly, he's got a whole chapter on the tactics of cover-up. And that sounds pretty straightforward in that organizations are going to hide documents, are going to gag employees, they're going to study it to death, spread things around. But what was really interesting to me here is that you have priorities. You're looking for solidarity, you're looking for free speech, and you're looking for the importance of what the whistleblower is saying to the public and to public protection. Tom, can you tell us in your history now since 1979, what are some of your top, most important whistleblower cases?
Well, I think that Franz and Robert McLean and Franz Geil are unsurpassed in making a difference, but they're in very good company. There was a gentleman named Dr. David Graham, an FDA scientist, who exposed that the super painkiller Vioxx was actually a killer painkiller. It had killed some 50,000 Americans from unnecessary heart attacks. And this was about as many Americans had died in the Vietnam War, only this was from a drug that our own FDA had officially decreed was safe. And 2 weeks after he testified in the Senate, a few weeks after he testified, the manufacturer withdrew from the market. And they had been making obscene profits on this drug. That's why they were continuing to market it, even though they knew that it was killing people. But after Dr. Graham committed the truth in Senate hearings, there was, within a few weeks, there was $400 billion in lawsuits from victims' families. And it really showed how the truth made a difference. The FDA didn't take this off the market, and the company didn't dare keep trying to sell it because they would be threatening their own economic survival if they did once the truth was out. There was the whistleblowers at the Department of Agriculture. We've taken statements from 400 of those guys, and they five times stopped USDA from deregulating meat and poultry inspection into a corporate honor system for government-approved food, where the USDA seal of wholesomeness would be vouched for by the companies that were trying to make money off of fecal contamination. And those people collectively made an incredible difference. Well, then there's the nuclear power whistleblower. Probably the one that was the scariest to me was the Three Mile Island cleanup. After the partial meltdown there, they needed to get out the 170-ton reactor vessel head, which was basically, to translate that into English, it was the radioactive rubble that was left inside the nuclear power plant. And it was spewing out radiation, and they had to get that thing out of there. And they could do it with a polar crane that was designed to carry those kind of loads. The problem is, the polar crane's brakes and electrical system had been totaled in the accident. And the Bechtel Corporation, which was running the cleanup, our local company for you folks, they wanted to get a $10 million bonus payment for a speedy cleanup. And if they went through the trouble to test whether this polar crane still worked or not, they would be risking missing out on their bonus. So they said, we'll just use the crane to pick up the reactor vessel anyway. They hadn't done any load test on it, see if it could actually carry weight. So all the top engineers refused to sign that this was lawful. They started getting the third degree, getting threatened with firing. And one of them came to Gap on the Friday before the head lift, they call it, before they're going to pick this up the following Wednesday. And we spent 40 out of the next 48 hours taking a 55-page affidavit from him and corroborating his concerns with the other engineers. And the chief engineer for the actual technical parts of the head lift said, if that crane doesn't work and it drops the reactor vessel head in the wrong spots, and there was a whole series of them outlined in the plant, we'll have a complete meltdown. We'll have to evacuate Philadelphia, New York City, and Washington, D.C. And the whistleblower, Rick Parks, who later came to work at Gap as an investigator, we filed his disclosure with Congress on Monday morning. We filed an anti-retaliation lawsuit with him Monday morning. We had coordinated with USA Today for them to break the story in CBS Morning News that morning. Congress called in all the utility executives and raked them over the coals, scheduled congressional hearings. The NRC, which had been in bed with the utility on this, suspended their approval for the cleanup. There was a complete investigation after the congressional hearings. They found that it was systematically illegal. They made them do the whole cleanup over again from scratch. A year later, after doing the load test on the polar crane, making over 100 repairs, they finally used it to lift out this reactor vessel head. And the vessel stuck, the crane stuck, over a dozen times. At one time, it froze for over half an hour with that 170 tons of radiation just hanging there in the air. And if it weren't for those whistleblowers, we might have lost Philadelphia, New York City, and Washington, D.C.
That's an incredible story. We're speaking with Tom Devine, legal director at the Government Accountability Project. And this hour, we are talking about whistleblowing, the importance of whistleblowers. So it's an honor to have Tom Devine on. He has decades of experience working with whistleblowers. He's sharing a lot of his wisdom with us today on so many cases. I'd like to also remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Tom Devine, just recently, John Curiaco, the CIA whistleblower on torture, in fact, the only person, I believe, that was given a jail sentence related to the torture, the use of torture, but was ironically prosecuted not for torturing, but for reporting and blowing the whistle on the fact that the CIA was, in fact, using torture. John Curiaco was released from prison just recently to finish out the remainder of his term at home. Could you make a few remarks about John Curiaco's case?
Well, the lesson learned from John's case, he was another Gap plant represented by Jesslyn Raddick, our Homeland Security Director, is that there's one rule of law for those who have power and are abusing it, and there's another rule of law for the average citizen who tries to exercise free speech rights to challenge those abuses of power. I mean, Mr. Kiriakou is challenging gross human rights violations that violate all the global treaties and commitments, and that they're crimes that he was exposing. But he was the one who got prosecuted. And I'm just comparing some of the recent instances of this double standard. Got General Petraeus, who was leaking classified information to his biographer lover to get a more flattering portrayal of himself in her biography of him. And the conventional wisdom by the power structure is, well, he's suffered enough. He's been embarrassed. His career has been ruined. Do we have to do more to punish him? Or there's the Zero Dark 30 movie. One of my clients currently is blowing the whistle on the cover-up of the fact from the Pentagon Inspector General, covering up the fact that Secretary Panetta and his chief of staff were involved in leaking classified information to these Hollywood movie makers so that the administration would get a more favorable portrayal in the movie. And that didn't even get to the point of publicly saying that we shouldn't do any more to these powerful people. The whole findings were censored in the Pentagon IG report. They covered up the fact that there had been classified leaks by the people at the top of the power structure. But you get somebody like John Kiriakou, who's blowing the whistle, and inadvertently something that's classified and isn't even significant gets put into the mix. Well, he's a criminal. We've got to throw the book at him. Or Tom Drake, who didn't even make any classified disclosures. He had information still at home that was classified because the IG had told him to keep his evidence in case they had more questions. And they threatened 30 years, sought 30 years of imprisonment of Mr. Drake on the theory that he had this classified information at home because he was intending to leak it someday to the media. Or Franz Gall, we got an assignment for him to do a lessons learned report when the MRAPs were finally freed up. We thought, oh, there was going to be a happy ending to the case. They're going to assign him to make sure this didn't happen again. He turned in the report. The report never was acted on at all. It just gathered dust, except for one purpose. There was a phony charge that he had put a classified information in a footnote for the report, and a criminal investigation was opened of Fran. There's one set of rules for people who have the power, and the rule of law is a totally different thing for people who are challenging abuses of power.
Tom Devine, legal director of the Government Accountability Project. We've just got a couple minutes left, and the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act was passed in 2012, and you were certainly involved in that. What other laws, what other kinds of protections are needed legally to protect people who want to commit the truth?
Well, the first thing we need to do is close the intelligence loophole in whistleblower rights. The abuses of power by the intelligence agencies have been the most significant threats to freedom that our country has faced. They've been from our own government. They involve the largest amount of money in terms of boondoggles. They have the highest stakes from the breakdowns in the effectiveness of the intelligence agencies. We never should have had 9/11. There's so many whistleblowers who had tried to prevent that and were just silenced within their agencies because it was uncomfortable information. That's where abuse of power threatens our country the greatest, and the rights have been exempted. All the free speech rights don't count in that area. So we have the most secrecy there, and that's why we have the worst abuses of power where the stakes are the highest. The intelligence community contractors have no free speech rights. The government employees have token free speech rights. There's no excuse for that second-class rights for people who are blowing the whistle on the worst betrayals of the public trust. That's one thing. The second thing that we really need is to get the same free speech rights in the criminal sector that we have in the employment sector for whistleblowers to defend themselves when there's that type of unusually ugly harassment. I mean, there's no excuse for these loopholes and second in inconsistent standards. I was just working on a whistleblower law for Serbia. You know, it's not, we don't in the United States consider Serbia one of the most enlightened, advanced countries in the world. Their whistleblower rights are equal for whether you're in the intelligence service or the or you work for a company or for the government. There's no loopholes like that at all in those rights. They apply to the criminal context as well as the civil context. The U.S. whistleblower laws are sort of a mishmash of patchwork rights that have been done piecemeal over decades. And at this point, there's not too many loopholes left, but the ones that are the ones where they're the highest stakes and the ugliest retaliation.
Tom Devine, Legal Director for Government Accountability Project, please once again give the website for your organization where people can learn more.
It's www.whistleblowersingular.org.
Tom Devine, also author of The Corporate Whistleblower's Survival Guide. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join the Project Censored Show. We have dedicated a lot of our time and effort to supporting whistleblowers in our recent books and certainly on air here at Pacifica Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. At Gap, we're huge fans of Project Censored. So, you know, the last thought that I have is, you guys keep up the good work, please.
Tom Devine, thank you so much. And I'd also like to thank Shanna Devine for helping put together today's show and putting us in touch with Robert and also back in touch with you. So, again, thank you to everyone at the Government Accountability Project.
Thanks for having us.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups.
That's our program today. Thanks for joining us. We thank our guests, Robert McLean and Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project. The Project Censored Show airs on 22 stations around the United States. For more information, to listen to archives to previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little poison, the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.